science has in this extraordinary position now, which is very confusing and very envy-making for those of us who are creators on a day-to-day basis. Here they are with the key to all knowledge. Here they are with these extraordinary new options, which make the Sorcerer's Apprentice look like Mickey Mouse.
Writer Alan Gurganus, together with physician and medical ethicist Jeremy Sugarman, he's here to talk about animal biotechnology, medical ethics, and the brave new world of genetic engineering. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Burroughs Wellcome Fund and the Glaxo Educational and Cultural Outreach Endowment Fund at the National Humanities Center. Last week, on part one of this series, we heard two sharply contrasting views of animal biotechnology and transgenic medicine. In case you missed that discussion, the speakers were Michael Fox of the Humane Society of the United States and Jeffrey Platt of Duke University Medical Center. They noted that transgenic medicine is at once on the cutting edge of scientific research and social controversy. A transgenic organ, for instance, is a pig's liver laced with human genes that spells potential good news for human patients. At the same time, it invites complex ethical questions about humankind's relationship to animals. This week, for additional perspectives, we turn to the comments of one of the country's leading creative artists and one of its leading experts in medical ethics. Alan Gurganus is the author of a novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, and a collection of short stories and novellas entitled White People. Later on the program this week, you'll also hear from Jeremy Sugarman, a professor of medicine and co-director of the program in medical ethics at Duke University Medical Center. Both Alan Gurganus and Jeremy Sugarman participated in a recent conference on the ethics of animal biotechnology convened by the Hastings Center, the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, and the National Humanities Center. Here is Alan Gurganus.
Well, I think of myself as a professional talker, as an amateur ethicist, as an observer of the scene, as somebody who is concerned about the culture, somebody who is aware, for instance, that half of my address book has breast cancer, and that, gee willikers, I wish a novelist had stood up 40 years ago and said, wait a minute, are we wise to be putting this stuff in this drinking water? So I think there's a moral obligation that we fable makers are obliged to offer. But also, there's this beautiful role of the informed amateur. I think in this age of specialization, in this age of expertise, in this age of political correctness, we're balkanized and told that only white people know what white people have suffered. Only black people know what black people have suffered.
Right.
We are not allowed to ask each other serious or probing or embarrassing questions. And so we retrenched our own separate little camps. And of course, nowhere is that balkanization more clearly enacted than in that terrible schism between the arts and the sciences.
You say that science is a form of patriarchy. It's like daddy standing over our shoulder, and we say, yeah, I'll do it. Don't ask, you know, it's not if I jump, but how high to jump, that kind of thing.
That's right. And I think that science has in this extraordinary position now, which is very confusing and very envy-making for those of us who are creators on a day-to-day basis. Here they are with the key to all knowledge. Here they are with these extraordinary new options, which make the Sorcerer's Apprentice look like Mickey Mouse. And here we are trying to push our images and trying to break through to the life of the imagination in a world that is more and more controlled by science.
Well, now, you are certainly not apologizing for literature, Alan. I mean, you make strongly the case that literature is, how do you put it, the original transgenic form of human enterprise? What about that?
Exactly. I mean, I think that one of the many fascinations with what's going on in science right now, this extraordinary ability to take an organ out of a pig and put it into a human being, and this is not... We're not talking about the year 2025. We're talking about next year.
Soon.
This is what's so amazing. And the reading I've done on the subject and sort of submerging myself in the information, I've been alarmed and startled and edified and thrilled to think that those thousands of people who are waiting for human-to-human heart transplants will be able to have a new heart. And the heart is coming out of a pig. Instead of making bacon, we're making another additional decade onto the lives of everybody who enjoys this amazing process.
Well, Alan, let me take you back to the keynote address that you gave to a group at the National Humanities Center about transgenic animals. Again, an unlikely sort of topic for a novelist, someone like yourself. You sort of took the measure of the perils and the rewards. You said that there are certain obligations that these scientists who belong to this fraternity and sorority, I take it, of this priesthood in our culture that they have to take into account. How about this?
I think that like daddy and mommy, I mean, maybe you had a daddy like my daddy who at wit's end would say, because I said so.
That's right.
Because I weigh 125 pounds more than you do and I pay the darn mortgage. That's why. Do as I say.
Right.
And I think that science has always had a tendency to look down a bit on the rest of us who don't have the terminology, even though the consequences of the science that is being practiced is going to alter all of us. My beautiful position in addressing the leading genetic artist and scientist of the period, all in one room, was to offer them suggestions as a narrative artist to indicate to them that they were not coming across to the larger culture. I tried to explain to them that if, in fact, the most comprehensive explanation of DNA to reach the American public came out of the O.J. Simpson trial, they were in real trouble. And that by ceding responsibility for explaining themselves, they had made a decision. And by absenting themselves from the larger discussion in the culture of the consequences of their magic, they had abandoned the very people that they are trying to save and cure.
Give me a sense, Alan, of the kinds of conversations that you had with these very talented people who are scientists and physicians, technicians in the laboratory, of their sense of ethics and their obligation to the larger community as they deal in these very arcane kinds of issues.
Well, I think that there's sort of a two-prong approach. One is science will always push forward. We know that from the past. I mean, if you have the capacity to make a nuclear bomb to end the Second War, and you have 20 minds as good as the people we had available to us then, it's going to be made and it's going to be used. I mean, this is the terrible truth. These people are aware of the horrible ironies of that moment and are trying to invite other people into the conversation. I mean, that's why I was so honored and delighted to be able to address them.
That doesn't mean that we're always going to get the results that we want necessarily, but at least we are being inclusive when we create the conversation.
That's right. And finally, this is one of my hobby horses, clearly what I do every day. What is the story of this advance? Mm-hmm. I mean, this sounds like a reductive and simple notion, but in fact, it's a profound idea. What are we trading in, both in terms of our inherent innocence as separate physical entities? I mean, there is an extraordinary invasion if you open my chest and pull a heart from a pig and implant it in mine and sew me up. What does this say about our relation to animals? I mean, literally, animals have pertained for us as metaphors, as emblems of our own foolishness, the mm-hmm. fox and the grapes. Aesop, right up till Harvey and Jimmy Stewart seeing fictitious rabbits.
Right.
I mean, this has been our way of dealing with the world. We project our own imaginations and identities onto these beasts. We see their follies. We admire them. We laugh at them, and we see ourselves more clearly. What does it mean when my pulse is being controlled by a bodily part of an actual pig?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if literature is transgenic, that is to say, this extraordinary belief that your life and my life and the life of all our listeners are essentially alike. That my heartache, my losses, my victories, my hobbies, my love of sunlight, my love of my garden, my love of my godchildren are all binding me constantly to other people like me.
Does biotechnology, again, from your standpoint as a creative person, a novelist, does it have answers that we shouldn't necessarily seek? Are there, in fact, mysteries that are necessarily off limits to humankind? How about that?
I think there are mysteries that are off limits, and I think those are the ones that we will never attain. I mean, I think
no matter how hard we push the envelope,
I don't think. I mean, in my own investigation, and it's a paradox that a novelist is a sort of scientist. A novelist is a scientist in the rag bone of the heart. There, I mean, here we go, mulling through motives, working on a kind of typology of human behavior,
right.
A sense of what motives do and don't drive us, so that. My own understanding is that I want to know everything, Wayne. I want to know every secret motive. I want to understand every hidden appetite. I want to know the best and worst about what a human being will do to and for another human being.
This is Dr. Faust with a smile. This is Frankenstein with the upside. This is Rappaccini in his garden with his daughter Beatrice, and it isn't going to have a bad ending necessarily.
Well, the beautiful thing about a book is that you can put it down. And we've all read the first 30 pages of a lot of purportedly wonderful books, and I used to blame myself. I think I'm failing, and now I blame the novelist. But the difference is that science is in the world at large, and it affects us whether we voted for it or not,
right.
Which is why we are facing a kind of emergency, a serious, serious emergency. If the capacity exists, and it has existed for some years, to prepare a pig by injecting it with human material that will make the pig heart more like a human heart, opening the chest of a person, removing his heart, replacing it with the pig's heart, incidentally killing the pig, we have moved into a zone that makes, 1984 look like 1810. I mean, we have passed into a whole new area of imagination. I mean, the great patron saint of the arts is Proteus, who had this extraordinary capacity to alter his essence to suit the situation. If he saw a young lady he intended to seduce who was about to cross a river, he became a horse to support her. And when he got to the other side, he became a beautiful warrior to seduce her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have reached an age when the differentiation between one species and another has been broken down. If you know how to look at it in a sort of metaphysical view, we have broken through to a kind of unity that Blake talks about and that we read about in the Old Testament.
Let me quote you to yourself, Alan Greganis. You moved toward the end of your comments here at this keynote address about creativity, bioethics, transgenic animals. You cite Mr. Einstein, the eternal mystery of the universe is its intelligibility, not its impenetrableness, but its intelligibility, this unity that you've been describing.
Exactly. And that's, I think, what all of us hope for. I mean, in our art forms, whether it be science or whether it be the area of literature, it's this notion of being visible to each other, of being permeable from one species to another, and of being beneficial to each other. But I mean, as a novelist, I find this about as thrilling as anything that's happened in my lifetime. It speaks to the natural world, the world of science, the world of ethics, and the world of rank capitalist. I mean, this, we're speaking in the, here we are in Research Triangle Park, where the cure for cancer and the cure for AIDS will come about, I say optimistically, in the next 2 or 3 decades,
uh-huh.
And where the person who finds it will be a godzillionaire who will be more famous than Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson and Jonas Salk rolled together. Great, great fortunes can be made or lost with
these inventions. And great ethical victories at the same time. So you are not either-oriness here, are you, Adam?
No, no. And I think that it's only by continuing to duke this out and to point the finger and accuse each other and say, be careful, go slowly, that we have a chance of putting on a slight emergency brake and slowing this process down long enough so that there are people from each of these disciplines on board when this first person wakes up with a pump in his heart that is a pig.
Alan Gerganus is the author of a novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, and a collection of stories and novellas, White People. His most recent book brings together four short novels. It's called Folk Art, and it's available from Knopf. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on animal biotechnology and transgenic medicine concludes now with the comments of physician and medical ethicist Jeremy Sugarman. Jeremy Sugarman is a professor of medicine and co-director of the program in medical ethics at Duke University Medical Center.
There tends to be in the popular media portrayals of uneasiness or distress, and this seems to happen with most advances in science and in medicine. If we think back, we were once afraid of magnetism. Magnetism gave way to electricity. Frankenstein was born for electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Electricity seemed to give way to nuclear fears. Here comes Spider-Man. And now we have animals. And we have animals that things are being done by scientists and by medical researchers in order to improve the state for humans.
Uh-huh.
But I think that beyond these portrayals in the popular media, there are a set of other issues. Institutions are wrestling with how to review this research. How do they know that it's safe? How do they know that it's worth placing people at risk in order to work towards developing new technologies that will be of use to humans? Institutional review boards have an interesting history. They came into play sometime in the 60s. They weren't called that yet, but they were developed as a result of a series of experiments that were done with human beings without their clear consent, and they weren't consistent with the science and the ethics of the time. And it was felt that by developing a formalized mechanism for review, that the ethics of science would be improved.
Mm-hmm.
We now have this codified in federal regulations, and research with human subjects is examined in this way.
Jeremy, you put a lot of issues on the table there. You suggested to me before our taping session when we were preparing for our conversation that it might be fruitful to look at what you call the analogies to current practices in clinical medicine as at a general level in looking for ways to wrestle with these issues that you have been describing. Can you be specific for me?
Sure. I think we can learn an awful lot from what's done in clinical ethics and with review of research with human subjects today. Let's take first as an example the notion of abortion. Now, in clinical medicine, abortion has obviously been discussed at length and no one's really solved that problem. Yet, we've come up with a way or procedural mechanisms for outlining different situations in which abortion might be acceptable, times that we allow abortions to take place and other times that we don't. While the debate continues, we've come up with fair procedures that people can agree on, even though they may not agree on the central question about abortion. Likewise, in the debate about biotechnology, it may be difficult or nearly impossible to answer some of the claims, such as the ones expressed in last week's program with Drs. Fox and Platt.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fox says, it's never correct to use animals. Dr. Platt says it's always correct to use animals. Those are irreconcilable, just like abortion. It may be possible on reflection, however, to come up with a means to agree on procedures in which the use of animals would be acceptable.
Jeremy, what do we do with the question of medical or professional arrogance? If you have all of these people talking and presumably looking for solutions and we're all working in a spirit of cooperation, you physicians are nonetheless strapped or burdened with that sense out there that you're kind of like a priesthood. And really, when we come down to the bottom line, you're going to listen to yourselves. And you're not going to listen necessarily to people who aren't part of your inner priesthood or inner sanctum. What about that?
The question about arrogance is an interesting one, and it has at least two parts. I think there's probably medical arrogance and there's scientific arrogance. Mm-hmm. The medical arrogance would come out in the context of a physician-patient relationship and in the use of, or the potential use of, biotechnological innovations in the care of patients. And I think that we need to be very careful about the degree to which we use the hope of patients when these procedures might be quite experimental.
Well, the nub of that patient-doctor relationship is trust. The nub of it is looking across the table at somebody and looking into that person's eyes and having a sense that here I can place my confidence. I mean, that is so obvious, but I think it needs to be stated. And is it or is it not a part of this as you struggle with biotechnology?
Well, I think trust is intertwined with the physician-patient relationship, and especially when people are sick or suffer some sort of illness, that they trust in their healthcare providers. They trust in the institutions in which they're receiving care. They trust in the institution of medicine and science to watch out for them and to care for them. And I think as physicians, we need to respond with humility to the high degree of trust that people put in us and make sure that we have our science and our ethics right, or as right as they can be, given the state of knowledge.
Well, this is a point that Alan Gerganus, the novelist, raised, that is to say, urging you professional people who, you exist, as it were, sort of in a little priesthood here, and you have special answers and special knowledge. Alan is reminding you as an individual and professionally that there is a degree of humility that is important here, out there in the general population, to remember.
I think Alan's reminders are quite important, and I think that he gives voice to patients or to society. I think the other side of the arrogance coin is the arrogance of science and the arrogance of science to proceed unchecked. And I think that Alan's point is both for physicians and for scientists, that there are concerns out there. They're very real and tangible and powerful concerns of people not understanding what's going on, not understanding what the drive is to proceed. And Alan's warnings, I think, should be heeded, that we need to do a better job explaining. We need to do a better job explaining in medicine. We need to do a better job explaining in science.
Is this the responsibility of science as an institution, or is it the responsibility of the people in the population who consume the medicine and the science? Where do we place the burden?
I think the burden is everywhere. I think we have a burden as scientists and physicians to explain in language that people can understand the types of things that we're doing, the kinds of innovations we're making. We need to attend to the language that people use with us. We need to listen for their malapropisms and the slang. We need to understand what they're telling us when they speak to us. And we need to do a better job to not sensationalize all of our advances and make sure that it just sells papers instead of communicating what's actually going on. It's not quite as scary.
Jeremy, one of the problems is that although there are a lot of scientists and medical people utterly well-intentioned, you also have a lot of people with a commercial impulse, an entrepreneurial impulse here, and it's in their best interest to stay secret, to keep secret the kind of work that they're doing. That seems to run counter to this idea of a democratic impulse, bringing many people to the table, many voices. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think that's really critical. I think one of the things we've been learning over the last couple of years, at least, if not a lesson that was known well before that, is that secrecy and science don't really mix. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to work on the staff of the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments over the last couple of years. And what we realized is that a lot of the discussions that took place in secret as science was moving forward caused a lot of problems in communications and problems that we as a country are now dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Now, this wasn't because you guys had bad intentions or you were doing sloppy science. It was a procedural kind of thing, right?
That's exactly right. The secrecy was being done for what are probably legitimate reasons, mm-hmm. legitimate reasons for national security interests to maintain those. Right. And here we have another set of issues. We have a set of issues in biotechnology about maintaining secrecy for proprietary reasons. Companies are putting in a lot of money into research and development, and they want to reap the gains from that. While that's a laudable or at least legitimate goal, if not laudable, it may cause some problems because it's not going to allow us to debate fully and openly the science and the ethics of the procedures.
So this means that the profession of science is changing its professional demeanor out there in the public to accommodate a more open approach.
I don't know if it's changing per se. I think that what we've learned so far in some of the examples in biotechnology is that it's important to disclose, to explain, and to explain easily. The example of all the problems that we encountered when there was a use of biotechnology in what was known as genetically engineered milk, when there are several other products that came to market at the same time using the same technology without any problem. And it had been argued at the conference that this was primarily because things were kept secret and it wasn't explained well. Now, there are several empirical claims in that, and whether that was really why things didn't move forward as some other products had, I'm not sure. But it's something important, I think, to keep in mind as we move forward.
Jeremy Sugarman is a professor of medicine and co-director of the program in medical ethics at Duke University Medical Center. He also serves as a senior policy and research analyst for the government's Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You also heard this week from writer Alan Gerganus. Both Jeremy Sugarman and Alan Gerganus participated in a recent conference on animal biotechnology sponsored by the Hastings Center, the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, and the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Burroughs Wellcome Fund and the Glaxo Educational and Cultural Outreach Endowment Fund at the National Humanities Center. Audio cassettes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 808. That's $10, program number 808. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Casting the Internet. In partnership with the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, Soundings is pleased to present a conversation with cyberspace pioneer Robert Metcalf of InfoWorld magazine. Robert Metcalf is the inventor of the Ethernet, one of the original models for the World Wide Web. He'll be here to talk about the history, development, and culture of information technology. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.